Artist Claire Hay read from her memoir, Claire Hay, Artist, Survival, Persistence, and Renaissance, at Society of the Muse of the Southwest, SOMOS, on May 21st, 2023, in Taos, New Mexico. Here are introductory remarks.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the SOMOS Salon, which is just perfect for an artist to read her memoir from. My name is Jan Smith, and I'm the director of SOMOS. Claire Hay is going to be reading from her memoir. She has a friend who's going to be introducing her. So welcome, Claire, and I look forward to your reading.
Welcome to SOMOS and friends of Claire and friends of SOMOS. It's nice to see you here. And thank you for coming. And to, as we know, the reading of Claire's new memoir. The title of her memoir is Claire Hay, Artist, Survival, Persistence, Renaissance, which kind of says it all. My name is Claudia Halati, and I'm happy to be here with you today. I'm a friend of Claire, and I work for a few hours a week at the Claire's Gallery. Claire works in Arroyo Seco. And when Claire asked me if I would introduce her, I was really happy to do so. I'm a psychologist by profession and an artist by inclination, so this event is a distinct pleasure. My own introduction to Claire happened shortly after I moved to Taos. Just a few months before, life in the time of COVID closed things down. Anxieties, limits, and endings of all kinds were becoming new norms. Claire gave me a copy of one of her other books, 33 Poems of Love and Loss. A spontaneous gesture of genuine generosity. I learned this was a core part of her essence and her approach to life. The time of COVID etched new patterns into old pathways, and it wasn't until a year and a half later that I visited Claire to thank her for her gift and to tell her what it meant to me. The poems were exquisite renderings of the very tender territory of lives lived long and deeply. I had reread them often in the sometimes melancholy and uncertain solitude of the time, and I was comforted by universal themes the poems painted of very personal joys, hopes, and losses. I appreciated Claire's capacity to express deep experience with understanding, insight, and compassion. As we learned to know each other, she began to share her process of writing the memoir and her thoughts and feelings about it. I was interested particularly in her purpose, and she said it was to have a conversation with her soul. I was intrigued. When the soul communicates, I listen. I've always felt that, by definition, a memoir is in great measure a work of fiction, shaped by memories that are mined for the purpose of connecting experiences with the meanings we assign them, and to hopefully understand ourselves and our proclivities in a deeper way. Interpretations are woven from memories, those capricious, tenacious vessels of recollections we carry with us through life, rather than a litany of facts organized to buttress truths. Claire's work is honest, insightful, faithful to her soul. Her memories are vivid and willing reflections of her journey. She has indeed made straw into gold. J.R. Moringer, ghostwriter for Prince Harry's memoir, Spare, in a recent article in the New Yorker magazine, said that a memoir is not even about you. It's not even about your life. It's a story carved from your life, a particular series of events chosen because they have the greatest resonance with the greatest range of people. He also wrote that what is omitted is as important as what is included. Claire's authentic voice in this memoir has deliberately mastered this difficult and delicate art, which gives her writing a certain mystery and energy. Claire's perspectives about her life are crafted into the story of her creativity and eventual freedom of expression. Definitely a tale of survival, persistence, and renaissance. The ultimate creativity is the art of life itself, after all. And it is said that the universal is revealed in the quotidian, a reality beautifully demonstrated in Claire's memoir. Her choices and the directions they took her reflect universal experiences on the wheel of life. She fashions a clear prow through the vicissitudes and triumphs she experienced. Unafraid of failure and fueled by curiosity, she experiments and she perseveres. You'll feel this in the passages she's about to read to us today. Not limited to, and in alphabetical order, Claire is caring, courageous, creative, curious, eclectic, fair, fearless speaker of truth, generative, generous, good cook, hardworking, inclusive, intelligent, intuitive, multi-talented, open to pivot when necessary, and prolific. Her creations in the mediums of clay, painting, design, jewelry, gardening, sculpture, and writing reflect her dedication, whimsy, and joy of life, which is how she shares with us who she is. A singular beauty of Claire is her consistent support for her extended community. She frequently donates percentages of her sales to local organizations promoting equity for the benefit of the greater good. Oscar Wilde said that the tragedy of old age is not that we're old, it's that we're young. At this stage of life, when many of us are mindful of completing the extraordinary jigsaw puzzle of who we think we are, Claire exercises the youthful generativity and curiosity foundational to all creativity. She continues to be an enthusiastic hollow reed for the muse and to give of herself in many ways. She survived, persisted, and is currently embarked upon her next renaissance. We applaud and are fortunate to have her company. And now, with great pleasure, I introduce you to my friend Claire and her soul. Enjoy your experience of them both.
I don't know where to go from there. I mean, so there are a number of people here who I do want to thank. So I will just simply read the note I wrote at the beginning of my book, which is a kind of combination, an efficient combination of dedication and thank you and explanation. In 2020, I found myself alone, isolated, and stuck at home, so bored and strung out that I began to write about my life. At first, my writing was just a disconnected pouring out. This was ground zero of aging. I was left alone with my reminiscences, mine to savor or put away in cold storage. Writing the history of my life began melting frozen memories. I was thinking again for the first time in decades about my childhood. Did these incidents really take place? Yes, some of what I remembered must have, could have occurred. I accepted these traces of my childhood as important signposts and clues to who I grew into, who I am. As the words collected, I began to seriously consider making a book. I was having a lengthy conversation with my soul that I began to share with my friends. Thank you, Bob, Holly, Tim, and Marcy, for indulging me by reading various versions of my ramblings. Thank you, Memphis, for listening so carefully to my recital of sections of the book. Your comments, pungent and uncensored, encouraged me to tell the whole story. I turned to the amazing poet, Sawney Morris, for help. She agreed to edit my book. Sawney, as an editor, was a rare combination of knowledgeable, firm, and kind. I survived, and what remains of my writing, revised and distilled, is, I hope, accessible and readable. I have claimed for myself, I have earned for myself, choice and freedom. I wish for every woman on earth the power and the opportunity to be fully herself. So I'm going to try and keep this reading fairly modest so that you will want to learn more about what happened to me. So I begin the book. I'm sitting on the precipice, on the verge of falling into an old lady's lap, mine. My thoughts are solemn. Has my life had meaning? Was I kind? Was I cruel? Could you say I was a good mother? I believe that I was a good wife. Was I successful? Does my art mean anything to anybody? Was it worth all those hours in the studio? I've created sculptures, prints, paintings, and my own jewelry line. Yes, my jewelry has a large, friendly audience, provides me with a generous living, and makes people happy. Have I ever been happy? Will I ever learn to be content? 75 years have collected behind me, and only a few years are ahead. I do not have much time to come to terms with my complicated life. I'm old now. I should accept and conclude and be reconciled. What really mattered? Please don't say who you loved and who loved you. These have been the great uncertainties of my life. My parents left me. I was a wanted child, yet for most of my childhood, I was neglected. Both my mother, Beatrice, and my father, Heinz, were charming, intellectual, and seekers of higher truth, fascinating characters, but neither their charisma, nor their political activism, nor their extensive reading of philosophy will make either of them a good parent. My karma, or just my bad luck? Unfortunately, both Beatrice and Heinz were crippled by their own problematic histories. They should not have become parents. Beatrice insisted. I was conceived with the reluctant help of my father. My parents' marriage quickly frayed after I was born. They were separated by the time I was 3. Because their marriage dissolved when I was so young, I have always viewed them as distinct individuals. Beatrice, Heinz, 1949. Beatrice and Heinz are no longer a couple. My parents' marriage has died. When we were a happy family, we lived in a majestic 8-room apartment. These days, my mother and I dwell in a modest flat. My mother sleeps in the living room on the couch. My dolls and I occupy the 1-bedroom. Beatrice has decorated the apartment in a dark palette of chocolate, caramel, and cafe au lait, our own little cave. Viewing the unraveling of my parents' relationship from the perspective of my own marital voyage, I have compassion for both Heinz and Beatrice, but I still feel the loss for my child self. After Beatrice gave birth to me, the daughter she so coveted, she wanted the next thing, her career. Her dance company began to grow. Her creative pulse was throbbing. My father was bewildered. Heinz could not follow the thread, as much as he acknowledged that he adored me. Claire, you taught me the meaning of love. He felt he was conned. My mother felt she was being suffocated. Their marriage did not survive their difference of opinion. My mother is the parent I love most and whose attention I crave. I never talk back to my mother or disobey her. I do my best to please her. For my child self, my mother is the weather, the moon, and the sun. All my life, I seek her praise with crumbs to show for it. Beatrice encourages my self-reliance. Often I am left without supervision to play in the backyard by myself, to make messy finger paintings, to wander alone in the neighborhood, or to comfort my dolls in an empty apartment. Beatrice often gets painful sinus infections. She was dropped by a dance partner, resulting in a chronic back injury that can send her to bed for days. Tuned into everything avant-garde, she finds a maverick doctor who promises to restore her health if she will follow his special diet. She commits herself fully to his philosophy, and I am required to participate in this strict regime. There are guidelines that we follow. No wheat, no corn, no dairy, and no beans. And absolutely no sugar. Ah, the cure. No exceptions are made for the natural wishes of a child. You cannot wear a costume and go trick-or-treating. You are forbidden to eat candy. I do not care if our neighbor offered to share. You are not allowed to have ice cream. Stop crying this instant. No matter how much you cry, I will not buy you the candy bar. The fruit salad I made you is your birthday treat. So my mother started dancing in New York with a modern dance troupe, and she met a man there who became my future stepfather, Jesse Lees. Jesse is destined to be my mother's fourth, final, and favorite husband. Beatrice Stronsdorf and Jesse Lees make an unexpected couple. When they get together, Jesse is 35 and my mother is 43. She is lean, elegant, and eye-catching. He is tall and corpulent with a soft pillow-like belly. He has greased, slick back, dark hair. His clever eyes are his best feature. When necessary, his warm, brown, long-lashed eyes emanate affection and sympathy. Watch out when they go narrow and go cold. 1953, we're in New York. In New York, all the strict laws of Chicago are erased. My stepfather, Jesse, gets to set the rules. I'm allowed to eat candy and dessert and ice cream. Little Claire goes on a binge. By the end of the year of eating sugar, I'm spending time in the dentist's chair. I have a mouthful of cavities. This is a very strange childhood, and I'm going to share some of it with you. I enter school in Manhattan, and I do not have academic difficulties, but I have social problems. I'm not like the other little girls in their matching outfits and poodle skirts. My mother neither has the time, nor the money, nor the inclination to send me to school looking like everyone else. So the years bleed out, and finally elementary school is almost over. Thank God. Sixth grade is the last year of PS 166. I am miserable. Even my teacher, Miss Gross, dislikes me. Yeah, a wonderful name, yes. It's the truth. Or I made it up. Who knows? The principal of the school, Mrs. Schulman, singles me out for her disapproval. One day, I'm painting at the classroom easel, a special treat. She stands beside me, looking at my work. Why is your painting so ugly? I have no answer. Today, I could answer her. As a mature artist, I give myself permission to explore. I linger in the chaos. The unresolved state can be hideous. Trust is necessary. I'm willing to risk ruining my art before I shape any creative project into order and what might be called beauty. I was never identified as a talented artist when I was a child, in part because I was never interested in drawing ballerinas or horses or making pretty pictures. My childhood is not complete hell. Sometimes I get to escape. Beatrice finds an inexpensive place to send the children for the entire summer, Circle Pine Center in Cloverdale, Michigan. I'm happy at Circle Pine Center camp, the happiest I can be. I swim in the small freshwater lake that is a mile hike from my cabin. I have the welcome opportunity to make art in a former chicken coop, now a workshop. I snack on delicious mulberries that are fertilized by years of chicken poop. I make a fired terracotta cat, which after all these decades still graces my bookshelf. I folk dance on Saturdays. I sing tunelessly, unnoticed, in a big, noisy group. Maybe my childhood was hell. I'm not quite sure if I could just say it wasn't. It wasn't completely hell. It was pretty hellish. And I reached a kind of the low points, you know? And at this point, I'm an adolescent. I have been abandoned by my father and relegated to a dust heap by my mother. In December, I give out. I stop going to school. Every night, I set my alarm for 8 in the morning. Every morning I get up when my alarm rings. I get dressed and I go to the library. No one notices. Life has lost all its savor. I am so tired. I do not want to continue. I decide that I'm going to kill myself. I'm resolute. I will take pills, go to sleep, and never wake up. However, I'm not sure of the lethal dose. Beatrice has a puritanical attitude towards taking medicine, so we do not have much on hand in the way of drugs. Only if she has a vicious headache will my mother reluctantly take one Anacin. One. Respectful of the power of Anacin, I'm quite sure that the four remaining pills in the long tin in the medicine cabinet will kill me. After ingesting them, I go to bed convinced this is my last act. The next morning, I wake up with absolutely no effects. Surprised that it will take more than four pills to kill myself, I purchase a new tin of Anacin, 12 pills. Each pill is ceremonially swallowed with a sip of water. Morning comes dull and unkind. I am awake and despondent as ever. Determined, on the third day, I purchase a whole bottle of aspirin with greater hope for the desired outcome. I methodically swallow each pill with a sip of water. It takes much longer to ingest an entire bottle of 60 pills, but I persevere. On the third morning, I wake up groggy, but very much alive, crestfallen and not sure what to do. I get dressed and go to the library. After a few queasy hours, I come back to the apartment where I find my stepfather making his breakfast. I stand by the kitchen table, ready to confess. Ah, Jesse, you're going to eat your picture-perfect breakfast. 3 sunny-side-up eggs, bacon, well-buttered white toast with strawberry jam. My mother is upstairs with her morning tray of black coffee, smoking her first cigarette of the day. I tell my stepfather what I've done. Jesse nods sagely. He is unmoved by my revelation. He says nothing, his face a blank. Jesse is focused on his breakfast. He adds another generous dollop of jam to his toast. He begins to put a fork to his eggs. I stand beside the kitchen table watching him eat. The eggs are swimming merrily in butter. Way too much butter. My stomach is swirling. Nauseous, I throw up on the kitchen floor. The floor is awash with vomit, decorated here and there with partially digested pills. I am sent to my room. So, within a few months, I think it became very obvious to my stepfather and my mother they couldn't handle the state I was in. So, no longer gentle or meek or quite sane, I have become too dangerous to keep. They call my father. They buy me a ticket for a plane to Chicago. I pack my bags. Within the week, I'm in Chicago. Heinz, upon picking me up at the airport, says, "You're not going back. They have sent you to live with me." Cast out, I arrive in Chicago during the summer of 1961. My father is unprepared. Heinz is still living on the cheap in a hotel room. His job at a credit bureau provides a slim income. Heinz has neither the money nor the mindset for a child. The theater calls me. As the wheel of fortune turns, in Chicago, I have the perfect opportunity to train as an actress at Second City Cabaret, directed by my cousin Paul Sills. In 1961, Second City is the hot new center of a fresh take on theater, improvised, witty, politically astute, with a cast of actors, many of whom later become famous. Second City is an exciting environment for a young girl, but not all of its inhabitants are savory. Hanging out at a theatrical nightclub and bar when you are an untested adolescent has its risks. Vulnerable, I get involved with a man connected to the theater. It is only 8 months since I was exiled from New York, and now I'm taking charge of my life. My first winter in Chicago since I was 6 years old. The fierce wind is blowing off the lake. Winter here is bitter cold and long and dull. Bored, I am itching for distractions. No one is monitoring how I spend my time. Obsessed with my inappropriate man friend, whenever I can, I sneak over to his apartment. He is excited by my young body, my virginity, and he wants the ultimate gift. It thrills my rebellious self to know that everyone would disapprove of our relationship. My admirer is pressuring me to have sex with him. His fervor fascinates me, but I'm not quite sure that I'm ready. When urged to surrender, I mock him. Are you crazy? Then I think maybe I will. No, yes, maybe, absolutely not. Well, maybe, why not? No. One gray, overcast Chicago afternoon, in his seedy rental apartment, I recklessly sacrifice my innocence to a salacious, greedy man. Afterwards, it's beginning to snow. He sends me home in a cab. Preening as he puts me in the cab, he tells me, "Now you can never forget my name." I am dumbstruck. I will never tell you who he was. I will never speak his name. Believe it or not, I actually survived this childhood. And you can read all about the various ups and downs, which there were many. And by March of 1967, on my own and without any substantial backing, I complete the requirements for a degree in English literature. And in this manner, I can hardly believe it myself, at just 21 years old, I'm a college graduate. If you don't think I have a will of iron. Whew. Anyway, so I want to start the next section with a little cheerier thing. Chapter one is called Happily Ever After, or As Close As You Get. Abracadabra, the gods and goddesses of love bestow their blessing. Glad trumpets, champagne, and sparklers. I walk on a gold carpet strewn with rose petals. Act 1. I am 21 years old, as beautiful as I will ever be. I have a college degree. I live in my own friendly apartment, and I have a great new haircut. My deepest longing for love is answered. I meet the man of my dreams. He's crazy for me. I adore him. He is tall, dark, and handsome. We have stars in our eyes. We live happily ever after. Hold the spotlight. Freeze the frame. I've just fallen in love. I know instantly that Michael was the man for me, and he already knew that I was the woman he would be with for the rest of his life. Will we live happily ever after? Of course not. But it is true love. I tell everyone that I have fallen in love at first sight. My father laughs.
You are listening to Claire Hay, reading from her memoir, Claire Hay, Artist, Survival Persistence Renaissance, recorded at Somos on May 21st, 2023 in Taos, New Mexico. This is KCI 90.1 FM, Red River, Taos.
Meeting Michael in 1967 and becoming a couple changed my life, economically, socially, and emotionally. Paradoxically, even before finding Michael, a new Claire was emerging. As my interest in being an actress waned, an unanticipated part of myself was born, the visual artist. I began my journey as a hands-in-the-clay, paintbrush thickly covered in paint, carving tools sharp, artist, later than most, fitful at first, coexisting for many years with my work in the theater, family life, and other adventures, but eventually dominating my adult life. I want to say a little bit about my early marriage. Michael and I learned that we are successful at doing projects together, Looking back at this period in my life, I'm fascinated by the enormous amount of optimism both Michael and I had. We experiment. Michael and I wear different costumes, trying to figure out who we are and what we are good at. We discard without regret what doesn't work. We believe we can fix any trouble that comes our way. These days, as an old woman living alone, my days begin in excellent spirits, but end with me falling asleep fully clothed on the couch while the television keeps me company. My choices seem limited by my commitments, by my physical decline, by my cynicism, and uncontestably by my knowing that my time on earth is meager. Am I being too pessimistic? Could I boldly venture where I have never gone? Where is the elixir? I need to gain my power. Could I afford it? So there's an interlude which has its up and downs and dramas like most life, birth and death. I'm not going to read very much about it, but I will say this, kind of summing up of it, reminiscing about this time in my life, the years of maintaining an old building, the years of parties and friends, I know that I did not feel completely fulfilled. This was not a period of creative or intellectual growth. This was an era of social interaction, parties, drug taking, random flirtations, and fancy dinners. I will learn that I am not a natural social butterfly. I discover in this period that I am not much of a drug taker. Seriously, the last time I got stoned was at a special champagne dinner. We served pheasant shot by a friend's hunter father, which was delicious even with the odd piece of gunshot. I had a strong reaction to the marijuana. I felt so weird, so paranoid, and so annoyed with everyone that by the end of the evening, I could not cope as a human being. So I became a dog. By this, I mean I descended to my knees, barked instead of speaking. I spent the rest of the evening on all fours, eating from people's hands, sometimes growling, and sometimes happily yapping until put to bed. This was the end of my smoking weed. 1976. The year I turn 30, I decide that I'm an artist. I do not say to myself, Claire, this is something you're great at. This is something you could make money doing. This is something you have so much talent that you must not let it go to waste. No, I have none of those certainties, but I have a persuasive longing for expression. I put my will to the task of making art and growing myself as an artist. There is little I can do immediately to follow my inclinations because I have two dependent daughters, a building to manage, and a husband with a demanding career. Now that the decision is made, my head is clear. The map is on the wall. I have begun to slowly journey down the path to becoming myself. Thank you. Anyway, thank you for all coming and listening. I hope you enjoyed the parts that I read, and there's certainly a lot of history in my life that's in the book, which I hope you will want to read about. Yes?
Your old studio, your old house, is we can walk to it, actually, adjoining street. And I remember visiting that home, as you remember, for the art tour, and you had out there, as I remember, the cat sculpture, the giraffe, the women's sculpture with the flowers growing out of her genitals. And so I have a two-part question. First of all, the first question is, what was to your knowledge, the most controversial artwork you did? And the second one is, how did you get on the Home Shopping Network?
Well, yes. That's a very good question, and you'll have to read about it. It certainly changed my life. I think the most controversial work that I've ever done, I've never shown to people. And I will say that spending this time thinking about my life and reviewing so much of the art that I've done that many people are not even familiar with anymore, that it has really empowered me to stand more as a fine artist, although I will continue to make the jewelry that makes people so happy and I'm so grateful for. I'm grateful for the reception of my talent. But QVC, you know, did change my life in the American sense, you know, because in America, all of us, we feel successful when we make money. Or at least many of us do. And I am one of them. So, you know, that was cool. And I live in the house that QVC built.
Do you have a favorite medium?
Well, the first medium was clay. And when in doubt, work in clay. Mm. Yes.
Can you talk about how Taos influenced you as an artist and brought your spirit out?
Well, I do talk about it because there is the magic of Taos. And there's something, I'm not like, there's a whole theme of brilliant landscape painters here. People responding to the environment. And for me, I have responded more to the energy of, and my father, you know, he looked at me and he said, you're just so much more you now that you're here. And I think it let me drop away some of the things that we all try to conform to, whatever family system we're part of, whatever dysfunctional family system we're part of, you know.
I'll ask another one. Okay. At what point did you know, okay, I'm going to be an artist. This is my calling. And what encouragement did you get? Was it a gallery? Was it a mentor to say, well, you know, you can do this?
Yes, I've had angels. I wouldn't want to call them anything else. I've had angels consistently. As challenging as my family was, there were all kinds of people who stepped up, and most of them were women. So yeah, I do talk about it, and it's definitely part of the book, how I was encouraged to do art, and the generosity of people in my life, which I hope I can reciprocate. Yes.
Claire, I've loved your art for a long time now, and I just want to thank you so much for being able to talk about a difficult childhood with grace and with goodness. And to me, you know, that makes you an angel.
Martha, did you have a question?
Excuse me. I wondered how, in the book, it seems very linear, at least your presentation.
Yes, it is.
How far in your age did you go in your book?
You know, it becomes a challenge. In fact, at one point I wrote a coda, which I removed. I felt at the point in which my adult daughters began to lead their own life, I just had to sort of stop because I feel their story is not my story. And that's kind of a funny business with your children who become, you know, I talk about them as children. In fact, my grandson said he loved hearing about his mother as a child. So I, you know, they were very delightful. And they are still part of my life, but they are grown women with their own ups and downs and crises and meaning. And I was very reluctant to talk about their life. Yes?
So what about your life?
Thank you.
Yeah. When your children were born?
I do talk about it.
You do?
Yes. I share my maternal life, and you know, I myself, my mother had a terrible, lengthy delivery of me, and so that's part of the drama of my life. You know, we can't escape our birth story, and of course I had a much easier time being the peasant than I am. So, but I include, you know, my family life, and I was reluctant to bore you or to engage you too fully. But I think for Taos, you know, we're all interested in the creative journey. I think it's a big theme in Taos. And it's a big theme for me. And I feel the Taos has been a place where I could be myself and do my own work and also be successful. How nice. Yes.
I don't have a question. I just want to say, since I've read the book, that she, in her reading, she focused a lot on her childhood, but the amazing thing to me really was how she brings everything around by the end. It's just really extraordinary and very beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I second that. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Some of you have read the book. Yes.
Did you handle Michael's death?
No. But my husband had very, very poor health. And his medical history became part of the fabric of my life. And dealing with medicine and doctors was inescapable. And there was a sort of, if a person has an enormous health crisis, it becomes the focus of the family. And there were definitely times when my husband's health was just the centerpiece. And I don't avoid it in the book. And some of you knew him, and I'm sure will be interested to hear about that. And also, you know, I fell in love with this man. He was a beautiful, handsome, interesting, charismatic man. And my marriage had plenty of problems. Oh.
Yes, so is life.
Yeah, it was real. Yeah.
I had a similar childhood.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know.
Let's have coffee.
Okay. And my dad left. My parents split up when I was 3. And my mother was always absent. And my father was totally absent. So I'm curious, when I never had children, when you had your children, what did you feel was the most important thing to do or say or give them that you didn't give?
There is a section I talk about it. I don't know if I can find it. The problem is when you, even as a sincere attempt to be a mother, the deficiencies of your own childhood catch up with you. I think they catch up with you. I mean, and that's one of the, fortunately, not, human beings have a capacity to grow. And I certainly grew. I wasn't my mother. But eventually we all go, I'm turning into my mother. What can I say? But, you know, there were things I admired about my childhood because I was, you know, I was given a lot of freedom. I had my husband had a mother who was very fixated on him. My mother wasn't. So I have a strong sense of selfhood. And I understood that was a good thing, mm-hmm. especially in my era, you know, mm-hmm. when there were a lot of, you know, mothers and father knows best and, you know, that kind of presentation of the 50s, because I'm in my 70s. I mean, I wasn't brought up to be that woman, and I cherish the fact that I had that spirit. And I wanted my daughters to have that spirit. And in some ways I succeeded, and in some ways I failed, because that's the human condition. Yes. But
I know one of your daughters, and she's delightful.
Well, that's, yes.
Good job.
Good job. All right. I'll take it. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you. Thank you.
You have been listening to Claire Hay reading from her memoir, Claire Hay, Artist, Survival, Persistence, Renaissance, recorded at Somos on May 21st, 2023 in Taos, New Mexico. This is KCI 90.1 FM, Red River Taos.